Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hi guys, nice to be back on. Thanks for having me, Kev. My name's Sam Karp. I'm a Crystal Palace fan. You can find some of my stuff on the Eagles Beak, and my Twitter is at sam_karp.
Yeah, hi everyone. Thanks for having me back on as well. Joshy here, Manchester United fan. You can find me on Twitter at docj_MUFC. And I sort of do various different little things here and there, podcasts, blogs, and things like that.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining me today, guys. Folks at home, if you listen to the end of last episode, you may be surprised that we're recording one this week, but weirdly, a lot has been happening in the Premier League. We'll start off with two managerial hires, Roy Hodgson at Watford, who, of course, Sam will be familiar with, and then Frank Lampard, who is joining Everton, respectively. That second one not fully announced yet, but by the time you're hearing this, it sounds like it will be. So I just wanted to get your guys' initial thoughts on who you think is a better fit for their new club.
Yeah, I can obviously speak a little bit more from experience about Hodgson. Obviously left Palace at the end of last season, and to be perfectly honest, I was actually a little bit surprised by the appointment, partially because I didn't necessarily expect him to take another job, although it's sort of worth pointing out that when he left Palace last year, he was about the only person who didn't refer to it as his retirement. I think all the media and everyone else was very quick to kind of describe it as that. So maybe he did always feel like he had a little bit more to give. But I was also sort of surprised because it seems like quite a sensible appointment, which you don't necessarily associate with Watford. I certainly think that they've got a better chance of staying up with him than they did with Ranieri, who didn't really seem like the right fit in the first place, especially after kind of how things went with Fulham. And out of the managers that are available, I'm not sure they could have really got anyone better. Under Ranieri, Watford have really looked like an absolute rabble over the past month, and kind of like they're crying out for someone who's going to instill a bit of discipline, stop them conceding goals, and kind of structure the team in a way that gets the best out of players like Emmanuel Dennis and Ismail Assar when he returns. And Hodgson's probably the man to do that, I think. When he first joined Palace, we actually lost our first few games, but then there was an international break where he kind of got to work with the squad on things like shape, structure, style of play. And he's already kind of been afforded that with Watford because of, this break that we were talking about before we came on air. So there's kind of a chance for him to sort of hit the ground running there in that respect. The only thing I would say is that with Palace, he actually inherited a squad that was sort of in a false position when he came in. I know there was always a lot made of the fact that he kept us up after, no one had ever done it, staying up after seven games, seven defeats, seven games without a goal, I think it was. But it was still a squad with players like Zaha, Benteke, Johan Kabay, Andros Townsend, a fit and motivated Mamadou Sakho at the time. So there was like a really good spine of a Premier League team there, I think, when he came in. I'm not sure it's the same with this Watford squad. I don't necessarily know enough about this Watford squad, but it just doesn't appear to me like it is quite as strong as that one that he did inherit at Palace. So I think this will be more of a challenge for him and perhaps even more of an achievement if he can keep them up. Similarly, there were sort of some signs at Palace last year that maybe his powers might be dwindling ever so slightly. Yes, I know, like he kept us up really comfortably, but we also suffered some really heavy defeats. And if Watford are sort of looking to be shored up at the back, then Watford fans might not like to be reminded of the fact that, we conceded seven at home to Liverpool last year, I think let in four against Chelsea twice, lost 3-0 at home to Burnley, I seem to remember, 3-0 to a 10-man Aston Villa. There were sort of some signs that, while obviously we did stay up and kind of it was mission accomplished from that perspective, there were sort of some signs of kind of defensive porousness perhaps creeping in. But yeah, I can't decide whether I want him to do well there, because Palace and Watford have kind of had a bit of a sort of Twitter rivalry anyway, let's describe it as that, over the past couple of years, just because we've played each other so many times, whether it be in the playoffs or the FA Cup or whatever, and they regularly accuse Wilfred Zaha of cheating. But yeah, I think they've got a much better chance of staying up under him than they did with Ranieri. From the Everton perspective with Lampard, it's kind of hard to be as, I don't know, it's hard to be as positive about it, especially just given from the outside, at least it seems as though he's got the job more based on the fan backlash to Vitor Pereira rather than necessarily his ability as a manager, which is still, I still find it quite hard to judge him as a manager. He did a decent job at Derby, but he had a really, really good squad for the Championship at the time. Getting Chelsea into the top four in his first season with the transfer embargo was also a decent achievement, but then it all kind of unraveled when there were expectations the following year. So yeah, for me, he's still a bit of an unknown quantity. And we've also never seen him in a situation like this before. As a manager, he's never really been in a position of adversity like the one Everton find themselves in at the moment. So it's kind of, yeah, it's a bit of a gamble to bring him in and sort of just hope that he's going to turn things around in that respect. You'd imagine he'll give Everton a little bit more freedom, which is different probably to Rafa, which the likes of Richarlison, Damari Gray might enjoy. But yeah, it's hard to predict. I think Everton's squad is good enough for them to pull away from where they are now. So if I kind of had to choose between the two appointments, I'd still say that Everton are more likely to stay up than Watford. But I think that will probably be more because of the players that each team has rather than necessarily the managers.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about those two appointments, it's kind of two extremes, isn't it? Hodgson being around the block, been loads of lots of clubs, 74 years old. I mean, that's ridiculous. You'd have thought he'd have wanted to go and chill out somewhere and get on with his retirement. But I guess it says something about him that he's come back into it. And obviously Lampard is much younger and a lot less experienced. So it's two kind of different appointments. And I think I largely agree with most of what Sam said. Like, you know, I think with Hodgson, it is a sensible appointment. He'll come in. He knows what he's doing in terms of coaching, things like that. And I think it's a bit like horses for courses. You know, he's a manager that'll come in and his aim will be to keep them up. I don't think if you were looking for him to then go on and build something for the long term and all that kind of stuff, I think you'd end up with a kind of Palace situation where he kind of establishes that Premier League safety, but then you need somebody else to just kick it up a notch, right? So yeah, that's probably what Watford are hoping for, and then we'll see if he can pull it off. With Lampard at Everton, I think it's an interesting one. It's probably the first time we can really judge him, right? But now we can really see what he's all about. Just for the reasons Sam sort of outlined. I mean, like what was said earlier, you know, he was all right at Chelsea for a while and then things started to peter out when there was some expectation. Everton, there will be expectation. They are not a club that is used to sort of being right down in that relegation dogfight. So he will need to do something different. And I think, you know, they have got the players that will sort of help them pull away. But over time, this will be the appointment that where you can really judge what Lampard really is all about as a coach, because he's got to turn things around at first, but then he will be expected to build that up, establish his style, coach that team, drill those players into a sort of a club that's then moving on up the table over the years, right? If he lasts that long. So that's the bit where it'll be interesting to see how he gets on, because if I'm honest, I didn't think he would be somebody that would get another job, to be honest with you, because the Chelsea job kind of got in because he was there as a player, and I don't think he did much with that team that warranted sort of a lot of praise, and yeah, so I didn't think he'd get a job. A bit like Solskjaer, actually. I was thinking who'd really give Ole Gunnar Solskjaer a go, but maybe you might see Ollie pop up somewhere, maybe not in the UK, but in another country. But Yeah, so it'll be interesting. It'll be, this is like a true judge, because it's not, he's got it. Well, I don't know how he's got it, because, well, he's got it because of the fan backlash as well. So there's going to be a lot of expectation from that perspective. So it's a difficult one to judge, but I think if you're just looking at who's going to stay up, Everton have the better squad. They've got a better individual players, better attacking players. I think that's super important when you want to stay up, because you just got to accept that certain matches, if you're in that sort of bottom half of the table, you will let in goals. But it's in those tight games against people around you where a player like Richarlison can just pull something out of the bag, and then, you know, it gets you up the table. So if you're going to talk about staying up, I think Everton will be fine. Watford are obviously much more in danger. But at the same time, with Roy Hodgson, they've got a manager who's kind of been there, done that, and it's a sensible appointment, and he knows how to work with all sorts of players. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I think I thought Lampard would have to be one of those managers that would be willing to take a championship side, and if he wanted to be in the Premier League again, have to get them up to it himself. But yeah, it seems like the fan backlash against Pereira was enough to get him the spot there at Everton. And you mentioned the attacking play. They might be getting Donny van de Beek as well, which we'll talk about a little bit later, which would probably help their cause. Watford, as you mentioned there earlier, Sam, have some pretty good attacking options, but yeah, their defense has pretty much been tragic since we've started doing this show in 2012, so not expecting that to suddenly turn around to save them here at the last minute, regardless of how good of a job Roy indeed does there. All right, next I wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about the transfer window. The people listening to this, it's probably day of or after as we're recording it. It is the Sunday preceding the final day of the transfer window. I was just curious to this point who you guys think has had the best window thus far.
Yeah, before I answer that, so your mention of Watford's defence, I mean, I remember a stat that I saw flying about this week when Hodgson was appointed, that something along the lines of they've had six managers since their last Premier League clean sheet, which is just, I know they've obviously been relegated in that time, but it's still crazy to think
the
about.
One I saw was that they haven't kept a clean sheet since before the pandemic in the Premier League.
Yeah, it's just, which is, yeah, I think that's something along those lines. Just, yeah, crazy stuff. But yeah, from a transfer perspective, I think it's almost hard to say right now, because I think the answer could even change within the next 24 hours, because unlike previous Januaries, it feels like there's some deals still bubbling away beneath the surface. It's kind of been, I don't know, the January transfer window is always fairly tame these days, I think, because it's, you know, teams are often unwilling to sell. The price is usually quite high. You know, teams are quite desperate as well. So there's a lot of sort of bargaining that goes on and not a lot of deal making, really. But I think that's been slightly different this time, partially because obviously you've had Newcastle, who have had such significant amount to spend. And sort of in keeping with that, it's almost tempting to say Brighton have had the best window, because they've somehow managed to fetch £13 million for Dan Burn, reportedly anyway. But yeah, it has been kind of amusing to watch the Newcastle tax kind of emerge over the course of this month. But yeah, given how little activity does typically happen in this window, I actually think that Newcastle have done fairly well. I know, as I mentioned before, I know they've got pretty much unlimited resources to work with at the moment, but it's still a challenge to bring players in during this window. You know, they needed to improve their defence. They've got Kieran Trippier, who played for the Spanish champions last year and is a proven international. And now they've seemingly got Dan Burn as well, who's also, I think, is an upgrade at centre-back. They needed improvements in midfield, and they've brought in a Brazilian international from Lyon. They needed another striker to help Callum Wilson, and they brought in a centre-forward who has consistently scored more than 10 goals a season for a bottom-half team. And, you know, even if he doesn't come off, they've weakened a relegation rival in the process. So, yeah, I think Newcastle, despite all the ridicule, have had a fairly decent window. They've got players in who are going to improve them and give them a better chance of staying up, I think, which ultimately would have been the aim at the start of it. And, you know, there's still, as I said earlier, 24 hours for them to potentially add more players to that. I'd probably say they're kind of, they've been one of the more successful in this window. But I'd also put Villa in there as well, who I think have made a couple of opportune signings with Coutinho, obviously, who I actually wasn't sure of. I wasn't convinced of that signing when it happened, but then sort of was immediately proved wrong in his sort of 20-minute debut against United the other week. But also Luka Dean, who I think's probably perhaps the signing of the month for me so far. just because, you know, there were obviously some bizarre circumstances which allowed him to leave Everton, and he didn't necessarily come cheap, but I think he's consistently been one of Everton's better players since he went there, and also one of the better left backs in the league. And to be honest, if I thought that he was going to leave Everton at any point, it probably would have been for a club kind of, you know, punching in either, you know, the Europa League or the Champions League places rather than necessarily Villa, with respect to Villa, obviously, but, you know, they aren't quite at that level yet.
Yeah, I think those are the two clubs, aren't they, that have had the more kind of significant numbers in terms of incomings and also in terms of outlay. I think Villa have done quite well, actually. I like their, well, not a fan of Villa, obviously, but, you know, if we're talking objectively, they've probably done some good business, and yeah, that they're using that Grealish money seemingly quite well. Obviously, no transfer, it can be judged as it happens. You've got to judge it a year or two down the line. But yeah, and then Newcastle, they're highly active. I think those are the two. I think Everton have brought in a couple of players, but nothing significant from what I can remember from memory. I guess the other significant sort of transfer is Liverpool's signing Luis Diaz for, I think, around 50 million. It's a lot of money. I don't know a lot about him, but they've got a pretty good record with their transfers. Most of the, I would say they've got, with under Klopp, it's been a pretty good hit rate. I think in recent times, probably that Minamino chap, but he wasn't that expensive, was a little bit of a miss. And then other than that, I think they've been pretty much hits, right? Seems to turn every one of these players into a top-notch player. So for 50 million, I'm expecting a lot from him once he settles into the system. I would say you can't really look past Newcastle and Villa in terms of the clubs, but I am interested in seeing what this Luis Diaz is all about at Liverpool for 50 million. So yeah, that's probably a way to sum it. Of course, the deadline is tomorrow, right? So as we record it, so things could happen. There's obviously there's been quite a lot of outgoings in terms of loans from United, Van der Beek being another one that may also head out. So yeah, and maybe with that happening, you might see something elsewhere. So yeah, this one, there could be some interesting stuff happening tomorrow, but it's a January transfer window. It's no longer one of those where people get really excited. So I would have thought it would still be a similar discussion to what we just had, even at the end of tomorrow.
Yeah, I was going to jump in actually, just you think about Tottenham's window so far, because it feels like every sort of turn you've been trumped, and now I don't know, I can't really keep up with it. It just feels like it feels like you're finally maybe making some sort of headway with some signings at least.
Yeah, you definitely cannot be blamed for not keeping up with everything that's been happening at Tottenham. So clearly we spent the majority of the month up until I think the 20th or the 22nd trying to get Adama Traore in to be a right wing back, a position that he's not profoundly great in. While also trying to get rid of Steven Bergwijn, who's an actual winger, so that inherently didn't really make much sense. But then Luis Diaz, apparently Paratici and his vaunted network of contacts, found out that Porto were in much worse financial shape than a lot of people knew. There's even reports that Liverpool had to pay some of the money before the medical was completed so that they could pay off some debts so they wouldn't be kicked out of Europe for the next few seasons. So apparently we had this kind of inside info about how rough Porto's finances were. And that's why we thought we could get him. Somehow this information shows up at Liverpool. They might have just had their own people that knew that as well, or the agent may have reached out. But anyway, Daniel Levy mentioned trying to sue Liverpool for them finding out this piece of information, which led to them pursuing him. So you spend a month chasing Adama Traore, you give up on him to chase Luis Diaz, and then you lose out on Luis Diaz. And this all happens with 4 days left in the window. Not ideal. So while Paratici has not been particularly inspiring as director of football, save for hiring Antonio Conte, which was huge, he just rings up his old club, Juventus, and is like, can we have a winger / center forward and a midfielder? And fortunately, they had Kulusevski and Bentancur, both who they were trying to ship because they were bringing Vlahovic and Denis Zakaria. So weirdly lucked out in the end. And Joshy, you mentioned outgoings. It's a little bit of a ridiculous list. So it sounds like Ndombele is off to Lyon. Lasalso is off to Villarreal. Brian Heal is off to Valencia. It doesn't sound like we're going to get rid of Bergwijn, even though we're bringing in another winger, which personally I like because I think he's really talented and brings something different to the squad. But that's kind of the quick synopsis of what's going on. We were one of 10,000 clubs reportedly offered Ousmane Dembele, but it sounds like he'll be off to PSG. But yeah, a very weird window where we have empirically gotten better. I think the window itself has been a success, but the way in which it happened has decreased confidence in Paratici and Levy and co. So that's kind of where we're at there. You guys already mentioned some pretty big signings to some of these clubs. If you had to narrow it down to like what you think the best individual signing has been thus far this window, who would it be though?
Yeah, I think I'd go back to Luka Dean again, just purely because of sort of the things I said before, just about, you know, him, the fact that he was, you know, he's been one of the best players outside that sort of traditional top six, you know, from the other 14. His set piece delivery is great. It was just a really opportune move by Villa. And to be honest, I'm still kind of amazed that Everton conspired to lose him in the way that they did, you know, the way they sort of backed Rafa Benitez in that row,
and then got rid of him 2 days
within
later.
Within the space of a few days, they've lost both Dean and Benitez. It just kind of said a lot about the way that Everton Football Club is being run at the moment, I think.
Yeah, I think that he's just because it was so bizarre, and he was pretty much, he's up there with the best sort of left backs in the league. It was kind of interesting they got him, but I think they've done a great deal getting Coutinho in. I mean, in the context of the fact that he's essentially coming in to replace what Jack Grealish gave them, right? And I know it's only a loan, but he came on against us and sorted out the game, right? And it's just, he's got that ability in him to just be a bit of a talisman to a club like that. So I think they've done really well. Even though it's just a loan, I think that could turn out to be a really exciting signing for them. Again, coming from a person who's just not a fan of either the club or the player, and I'm trying to be super objective, so for the benefit of the podcast. So yeah, but I think we have to go with that.
Fair enough. All right, we'll move from there into something a little bit less fun, but at least there's a direction to it now. After some questionable postponements, shall we say, the Premier League has now implemented a rule that requires you to have at least 4 COVID-positive players in order to have your match suspended or postponed. And I'm just curious if you guys view this as a positive step, if you think this will eliminate some of the more questionable ones where it was like compounding injuries, AFCON, cards and suspensions and COVID all into one bundle that were preventing some teams from playing.
Yeah, I wonder if there was a particular questionable postponement you were thinking of there, Kev, as you rattled off.
Both in terms of my personal opinion and the timing.
I think it is a step in the right direction, really, isn't it? It just adds a little bit of clarity that we never had before. I was never kind of in that camp that there was this constant line that seemed to be peddled on Twitter whenever one of these games got postponed, that, you know, they should just play the under-23s and get on with it, which I just don't really follow that line of thought, because it just wouldn't have been entertaining for anyone. Like, you know, there are teams in the league with different, you know, quality of squad, and some teams are able to spend a lot more than others and have a lot more squad depth, so no one really wants to watch a game where you've potentially got a fully fit Liverpool or City, for example, playing against Palace's under-23s because their first team squad has had a COVID outbreak. That's kind of where the integrity of the competition, I think, would have broken down, and the league ultimately would have lost a bit of value as an entertainment product. So they did sort of need that clarity, and I think as you sort of said, it became clear over the last few weeks that the rules as they were just weren't specific enough. They weren't transparent enough for fans either, and teams were just starting to bend them in their favour, which, to be honest, you can't really blame them for, right? I mean, everyone was at it. It all sort of came to a fore with Arsenal in the North London Derby, but I'm sure that every team behind the scenes was kind of manipulating things in their favour, because that's what the Premier League has been built on, right? It's sort of, you're always going to protect your self-interest where you can, because, you know, whether you're going for the title, the top four, or trying to stay up, there's a lot at stake financially, and you want your best players available as often as possible. So really it was down to the league to kind of to put a stop to that and introduce something that was going to kind of finally just give everyone a little bit more clarity over the situation, which we just haven't had. Because as you mentioned, it felt like teams were getting games postponed because of their injuries or other absences, which just didn't feel right at all. With this new rule, at least we know that, you know, there has genuinely been a COVID outbreak. It's not teams trying to sort of get around things in any way. And if there are, you know, one, two or three cases, it's going to be felt more by those with longer injury lists and maybe lighter squads. But that's just the way it is, unfortunately, and they'll kind of have to find ways to adapt. And, you know, also hopefully, you know, it won't be as much of an issue in the run-in, given that, I guess, cases kind of seem to be trending downwards a bit in the UK. So you'd hope the situation in the Premier League kind of starts to mirror that. And this conversation is kind of one that we just leave behind us in December and, I guess, the start of January.
Yeah, I think the main thing it does is just provide a little bit of clarity and consistency for people to interpret the rules. So then you don't get all this, I'm going to be polite and say confusion. But I mean, it's just an arbitrary number, isn't it? I don't know how, there's no kind of science behind it. They've just kind of stuck their finger up in the air and gone, yeah, let's go with four, right? I mean, for me, four or two or seven, there's a risk of spreading. So you just need to get all of these people isolated. That's the key piece. So, but yeah, I guess it gives a bit of clarity and there's a line that you can draw and say, right, you got three, you've got to play a game. You got four, you don't get to play a game. It just feels arbitrary, but it's at least clear, and they can just fall back on that as the reasoning behind what games go ahead and what games don't. I don't really have much else to say about it because I just get drawn into discussions around COVID and the wider sort of management of it, and then I get very frustrated and start swearing. So I'll probably leave it. But yeah, I think the good thing is clarity, and now you can sort of get on with it and there won't be any of the stuff that we've seen recently.
Yeah, to your point, Joshy, the arbitrary nature of 3 to 4 could lead to situations where a team gets forced to play on, say, the Saturday, and by the Monday they find out that they actually had 7. And then you're like, oh, well, then why did we play then? But because of that time delay. But yeah, we'll see how it goes. But I agree with both of you. I think it is good to just, whether or not the number is founded in anything other than just picking a number, I don't know. But it still feels a little bit better to have a number that will confirm that you are at least having, at least makes it sound like it's a good thing, but that you're having a genuine COVID issue at your club, and that this is a solution for that and not for all of these kind of ancillary issues. All right, we'll take a quick break and then we'll be back with club-specific questions for each of our guests.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, and we are back. Sam, we'll start off with you. I wanted to really talk about this aftercare program with you that Crystal Palace just launched. For those that haven't seen it, go look it up. We're about to talk about it a little bit here, obviously. But the short version is that if a player leaves the academy, and even in the press release, it left a little bit room open for players in the first team, but once players leave Crystal Palace, they'll have a 3-year period in which they'll still be receiving support from the club, helping them figure out what to do post-football. So I was just curious if you have any more information on that or just how proud you are that Crystal Palace have spun up an initiative like this.
Yeah, it actually kind of surprised me that this was being billed as the first time that a club has done this sort of thing. Because I just can't believe that it's not been done already. It just seems like it just seems so normal and almost like a basic responsibility that clubs should have, which probably speaks to just how overdue it is. And yeah, I guess I'm proud of the Palace, the first to do it. We've always been quite proud of our academy generally, and it's sort of a massive part of our marketing. You know, we put Wilfred Zaha famously on every single piece of, you know, marketing that goes out. You know, Nathaniel Collins, another one that's come through, Victor Moses over the years. So yeah, it's kind of, it's something which is consistent with our identity, I suppose. And, you know, whether you're a United fan like Joshy, Spurs like yourself, Kev, or Palace like me, we've all heard loads of names over the years who are supposedly the next big thing, and then you kind of, you never hear of them again. So there are, you know, there are so many players and academies across the country who have dedicated their lives to football, but we know that only a handful of them are going to make it, not only at their own clubs, but as a professional in general. So, you know, having not gone through that process myself, I can kind of only imagine that it must be incredibly hard for those players who are released, who are told that they aren't going to be kept on after all that commitment, all that time, you know, huge chunks of, you know, their lives, basically. And you can only imagine how lost in the world they probably feel when that journey does come to an end, or when they're told that that journey is coming to an end. So yeah, we've read plenty of stories about academy players who have been released, and because they haven't known where to go, you know, whether they, you know, they have a bit, and because they haven't necessarily had the kind of right education during that time trying to become a professional footballer, they've kind of spiraled into other things like depression. Sometimes the situations are even more tragic than that. So hopefully something like this will be able to help those youngsters see that, you know, football isn't necessarily the be-all and end-all. They can find a different career path if being a professional doesn't quite work out, and clubs are there to actually help them. So yeah, I think it is a really positive step, and hopefully other clubs are looking at this and it can kind of be a catalyst for them to do the same. Because yeah, as I said at the start, to be quite frank, I think these clubs have a responsibility to these kids to do that, because, you know, they're giving them, these kids are giving the club their service for however many years trying to make it. So, you know, I think it should only be a basic responsibility for these clubs to at least help them with the next steps if they aren't going to keep them on beyond that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I wouldn't be surprised if very quickly we see a lot of clubs kind of cloning this program, because this feels like one of the things where not doing it saves you a little bit of money, but it does so much more. It could potentially do so much more damage not having something like this than the money it would cost to just make sure that all these players are in the right state of mind and have a promising future outside of football after leaving academies. The other question I wanted to talk to you about was Donny van de Beek. I told you midweek when I was inviting you on that I wanted to talk about it. It sounds like you won't be getting him, but my main question the whole time was, did Crystal Palace fans ever really want him? Because you currently have Conor Gallagher, obviously in fantastic form. Whether or not you'd be able to get him after this incredible year, TBD. But I was just curious if that was a player that you guys were interested in, or if you'd be more than happy to just let Gallagher keep kind of doing what he does.
Yeah, it was a really weird one. And to be honest, it felt like a really familiar transfer saga for us, in the sense that it was one of those that it felt like it was never going to happen, despite how much reliable people were telling us that it was going to happen. So when it emerged yesterday that Everton were interested, and it just felt like, oh yes, that's about right. I don't know, just Donny van de Beek just doesn't feel like the caliber of player who ends up at Palace. He's a little bit too high profile for us, I think. But yeah, it's a hard one. I've kind of, there were some, I think you, there was, yeah, there were very kind of two distinct camps. There were the people that really, really, really wanted him and thought he'd be a great addition to the squad. But then you had people that really, really, really didn't want him and just, you know, thought it'd be a waste of money and a waste of our time. There was not really any in between. It was just a very, sort of, there were two extremes, basically. And I have no idea if I was that excited about van de Beek joining, to be honest. I know it's easy to say that after the event, now that we've reportedly missed out on him. But I think I was curious more than anything, because there isn't really enough evidence to know if he is actually a good Premier League midfielder yet. You know, he's been starved at football at United, barely played a game this season. And I've always kind of felt that United fans sort of project some sort of hope onto him in a way. It kind of reminds me of a similar thing that we had with like Max Meyer at Palace, obviously not quite as high profile, but he arrived with like a similarly really good reputation, European player with a good reputation. He struggled to get into the team at first, and when he did, like, look decent, but never really properly grasped his opportunity to prove that he should be playing instead of those people, instead of the incumbents, the players that were holding the position at that time. But our fans still tried to convince themselves that, you know, because of the reputation that preceded him, he was the answer to our problems and it was the manager's fault for not playing him. So yeah, with van de Beek, I was kind of split between the idea that yes, he would undoubtedly bring some more quality to our midfield, some more balance while James McArthur and Cheick Kouyaté are out. But then you just look on the other side of that. I was wondering, you know, because I think United wanted the loan fee. There was talk that they wanted, these were reports, but there's reports that Everton would be going to be paying his full wage. It's a lot of money for kind of, you know, what, 15 games for the rest of the season. It's not really enough time for someone who hasn't been playing to get up to speed, to have that much of an impact. And then at the end of the season, you just kind of send them back to their parent club. So, and as you said before, it could have quite easily stunted the good stuff we have going on with Gallagher at the moment, perhaps stunted Eze's comeback as well, who is still kind of trying to feel his way back into things. So, two sides to it, really. I mean, I'd have welcomed him if he had come. I think it would have been a bonus. But at the same time, yeah, I'm not gutted we've missed out on him, because I think we do have options. So, yeah, having said there were two extremes to the argument and no one sat in between, I am actually one of the few people who actually sits in between.
but you've probably judged it about right. I'm a United fan who sits in the camp of, I just don't see what people see in him. I mean, I do see what people see in him, but they, like you said, project a lot onto him when I don't see the kind of impact that you'd think he should be having, right, when he comes on, even for a half. I've only ever seen him play 45 minutes. I've never seen him really impact games properly. I just think he is one of those players that's a system player. Like, he's in the Ajax system with those players who all play the same within that system. You know, he probably looked fantastic, as did all of them. But if you think about it, those players that have left, Frankie de Jong, this chap, but even Ziyech to a certain extent, I don't think any of them have really gone on to show that they are one of the top tier players within their positions, which you kind of expected from Frankie de Jong and Matthias de Ligt, definitely. And Ziyech as well, you kind of expected a bit of that. I didn't expect that from Van de Beek, but I just think he's that kind of system player. And in the Premier League, it moves so fast. And I just don't think he just needs a lot around him, to people playing on the same kind of level as him within a system where they all know what they're doing. And United is a complete shambles at the moment. So we don't really have much of a system. And the one player who has been consistently playing at a high level is Bruno Fernandes, who essentially plays in Donny van der Beek's best position. So there's not much you're going to do there. So for me, I've never been one of those guys who's kind of gone, oh, why are we not playing van der Beek? I mean, there's a reason why he wasn't playing under Oli. I just don't think that was one of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's signings. It was just sort of brought in. And there's a reason why Big Ralph isn't playing him, right? And he's now going out on loan. He's clearly not showing it in training for the systems that Solskjaer and Rangnick want to play. And that's saying something when the people ahead of you are Fred and McTominay, right? Because Pogba's been injured, and Matic. I mean, that is just a shocking
trio. Because your point is, you could play
of midfielders,
because you could play Bruno and him rather than playing too defensive in Fred and McTominay.
You could play, if Van der Beek was showing enough, he could come in, and apparently he could sit in that kind of, in that two behind Bruno Fernandes, if you're going to play a three-man midfield, right? So him and Fred, or him and McTominay, or him and Matic. But he's clearly not good enough to usurp one of them, because they're just so scared about playing just a single one of those three. Because we just don't... Basically, Fred and McTominay, if you combine them, is what a good central midfielder should be doing in that position, except we have two players doing it. So you can't drop one of them, and it becomes difficult, and Van der Beek isn't good enough to be that other single person either. So I don't think you've missed out, to be honest. I think the way Palace play, I just don't think he would fit in that. He might fit in at Everton. It's just a kind of he needs to get out and have a fresh start. Let's see what he can do. I'm not gutted that he's going. That being said, I'm kind of gutted that the other three are staying. So
we do need midfield.
Well, you know, go in for one of them then, I suppose. Or now that we're trying to sign every central midfielder, maybe you should get like a Winks or something off of a off of us there. But yeah, no, I think those are all excellent points. And I was indeed going to ask you your opinion on Van de Beek. So I appreciate you just kind of jumping into that on your own. Next question I had for you is about the top four. So last week we had the show where, you know, now everybody's reached the halfway point of their season. Some people are five matches past it, but everyone's now reached that point. And a lot of people were sounding confident that Tottenham might be able to get that top four spot. Obviously, that would be at the expense of Manchester United. Would that represent a big surprise to you? Are United fans still expecting that you'll get top four this season? Or with the managerial shift and everything going on behind the scenes at the club, would it not really be that big a shock to miss out?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it would be a massive shock to miss out the way we're playing. I know we've picked up a couple of wins, and we've got, some games in hand on some of the teams around us, but then other teams have games in hand on us. It just wouldn't be a shock just because just how poor this team is playing. And it's not just the big things where we're talking about missed chances and creating chances and all that kind of stuff. It's the little things. The passing is so sloppy. It's unbelievable. It's something that just has been getting on my nerves for so long. It's so bad. The team is so poor. Like, they just think that if you hit a red shirt or you hit a player in your team, that's great. You know, you've done your job with that pass. There's no thought process into actually it needs to go ahead of them. It needs to go onto his right foot. It needs to go onto his left foot. It's, you know, let's not under hit it. Or, you know, it's just so poor. And these are basic things. So when you're talking about basics at that level, and then we talk about the pressing is so disjointed, which Rangnick was supposed to be coming and sort out. Defensively, we're better under Rangnick, but of course against Villa, we again showed our potential to absolutely screw things up. To answer your question, I wouldn't be shocked if we don't make top four. Of course, I wouldn't be happy about it. You know, the players we have in the squad, we should be doing a lot better. I just think one of the questions later was where would I hope that we upgrade is in central midfield. When your midfield is so poor, and it's such a key area, central midfield, when it's so bad, everyone around you is impacted. The defenders drop that much deeper. The wing-backs don't push up as much as they should be doing, or the full-backs don't push up. You don't get the kind of penetration through the midfield into the attacking areas. You see players like Cristiano dropping deep, Bruno Fernandes dropping deep, because the likes of Fred and McTominay and Matic just don't have that passing ability. So it really impacts everywhere. And it's such a huge deal for us at the moment. So, I think the league probably represents where we are. I think we'll be challenging, but I wouldn't be surprised if, again, we hit a run of fixtures where we lose three or four in a row. I mean, actually, when Ralph Rangnick came in, I looked at the fixture list and just went, this is the perfect fixture list for him to bed in, because on paper, we weren't playing a top six team until March. And of course, we've dropped points anyway, we've lost games, and then we'll hit March, and then we play Liverpool, City, Chelsea, whatever, I think, all in the space of a month or something like that. That'll be fun. And Spurs, you know, we're playing people around us. So are we going to be good enough to get points out of those games? Doubt it. And will we be embedded in that fourth place position by then? I hope so. But yeah, so I think, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if we don't make that top four. And given the way that the team is playing, I'm not sure that I'd be unhappy about it. But yeah, it would just be one of those things. Again, you know, we're getting used to it, to be honest.
Gotcha. And then we'll finish up with a far more serious topic, which is the allegations about Mason Greenwood. Obviously, there's a lot of information still going to come out about this, so I'm not expecting you to know every detail of it, since no one does. But Manchester United as a club have already responded by banning him from training and from playing while we try to get all of that information. And I was just curious, from the fan perspective, what goes through the minds of Manchester United fans when they see this horrible act being accused of one of their players?
Honestly, if you know, obviously it's just allegations at the moment, but the evidence seems pretty damning. I've got no two ways about it. Just whatever needs to be done to him needs to be done. I'm talking not as a football fan, as a human being. Don't really care about his career or anything like that. What about this girl that he's been allegedly doing these things to? Of course, there's that 1% chance, or however many percent chance, that there's something else going on and it's been faked or something like that. But you're clutching, right? My instant kind of reaction is just disgusting. Honestly, end him. I'm kind of done, right? This is, there's not much else I can say about it. In truth be told, I haven't gone into social media or anywhere else to look at the details of even, you know, apparently there's a video clip. I haven't listened to it, though I've read a transcript, not a video clip, an audio clip. And then there were pictures, or I think there were pictures. Again, I've just seen stills. Maybe there was a video, I don't know. But ultimately, you know, I'm not approaching this as a football fan. You know, then, because if you approach it as a football fan, you're going to say things that just not relevant right now, you know, because I've seen people say things like, oh, he's ruined his career. Who cares about that right now? There's a girl or a woman that he's done some pretty horrific things to. So that's really far more important. So for me, you know, of course, if it comes out that he hasn't done all these things, then fair enough. But at the moment, the evidence is super damning. And yeah, I'm just I don't know what else to say, really. It's pretty disgusting from what I've seen. And actually, if I'm really truthful, I haven't been through social media because I don't want to see it, right? Because this kind of stuff is not, it's not really a Sunday afternoon reading, to be honest. And yeah. I've only picked up stuff from my WhatsApp group. So I think, yeah, that's really where I stand. I'm pretty angry, to be honest, that he, you know, he represents the club and is doing that kind of stuff. But more sympathetic and hoping that this woman is okay and she gets the help that she needs.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. And you're right. There have been loads of discussions about what this means for his footballing future and stuff like that. Same way there were with Mendy at Manchester City at the same time, where people were like, oh, what does this mean? When's he going to be back? Do they have to sell him, or is he just not available? And those just aren't important questions in a situation like this. So,
I mean, I think I would have that discussion once everything has come out, right? And we know where we stand. I don't mind saying, but it will be in a retrospective manner, in the sense that, what an idiot. Do you know what I mean? But right now, you just hope that everything is sorted with this, the girl is safe and all that kind of stuff. He should not represent the club. So I'm very happy the club have come out and been very definitive on that front. And then of course, he has to go through due process and gets his, you know, fair shot at a trial and all that kind of stuff. But right now, you know, I mean, evidence is pretty kind of strong, right? So I'm not sure what is going to let him off. You just got to go with, you know, it doesn't matter that he's a footballer that plays for Manchester United. You know, if this was just a young guy who did it elsewhere and he got caught out, then that exact whatever happens to that person needs to happen to Mason Greenwood, and actually probably more because of the position that he's in. But I don't know the law and I don't know how that will work. Just pretty actually devastating, you know, as in just like really sickening, really, to be honest with you. Just think, like, if that was my cousin, or I don't have a sister, but, you know, I've got cousins, or if that was a friend of mine or something like that, this is pretty horrible.
Yeah, definitely an awful situation. And I think you've, stated your case very well there, and I think that's probably how a lot of people are feeling. It's just that it's disgusting. Hopefully he didn't do it. Evidence is certainly mounting, and we can address all of that more as you know, actual sentences and stuff like that, if they happen, when they happen. We will try to drag things back towards football in player watch here, where I just wanted to ask you guys, with just the day left in January as we record, what position do you most hope your club will address before the window closes?
Yeah, I can't see Palace doing anything, to be honest. But Van der Beek, things have been pretty quiet this January, and it feels like we're waiting until the summer to strengthen again. There's been talk of us trying to make JP Mateta's loan move permanent, which would be quite a turnaround, given it was only the start of this month that he was being linked with a move to St Etienne amid reports that Vieira didn't really rate him. So yeah, fair play to him for his recent performances. He's scored a few goals and just kind of, yeah, turned that around and has won a few people over. If you sort of ask me where I'd hope we strengthen, I'd say the midfield, despite, again, saying before that Palace didn't necessarily need Van der Beek. But we have been quite reliant on a 34-year-old James McArthur, a 32-year-old Jake Kuyate, whose contract is up in the summer, and obviously also Conor Gallagher, who will presumably be going back to Chelsea in a few months, and probably, I'd imagine, staying there and going in and around their first team squad. So yeah, midfield would be the place, but yeah, I think that can and probably will wait until the summer now.
Yeah, United. I mean, where do I hope we strengthen? Central midfield, I talked about it earlier. And in that sort of more defensive sitting position, someone who can pass it about and also do that sitting role. It's a lot to ask, obviously, but there are players out there that can do that. I just don't see us doing any business tomorrow. I think we're saving it up for a summer sort of spend, what with a new manager potentially coming in as well. Unless kind of somebody pops up in the last minute who is on our kind of top target list, I don't see us doing any business. And that's also highly unlikely, obviously. Our top targets tend to be players who aren't going to, who clubs don't want to leave, let loose in sort of January. So, yeah, I don't see us doing any business. But if we do, I hope it's in central midfield.
Well, as I said before, Tottenham, way too many central midfielders now. So get on the horn if you really want.
We want some quality in central midfield.
That's entirely different. Also, earlier when you're talking about Donny van de Beek and you're talking about systems and patterns of play, that is how Conte plays. And we do need a more creative option there. So maybe long term, that's a thing that could be looked at. We'll wrap up with match previews. We've obviously had this random international break, which even before the show, we were all discussing why it's even happening right now. Obviously, CONCACAF qualifiers happening at the same time as AFCON maybe being it. I think South America is also doing their internationals, which is why like Luis Diaz is over there, and it sounds like the same for Rodrigo Bentancur, who's about to join Tottenham. But we're going to have actual matches in the FA Cup here, at least here at the weekend. So I was curious, we'll start off with you, Sam, to talk about Crystal Palace. You're going to be hosting Hartlepool. Are we thinking Crystal Palace going to take the cups a little bit seriously this year?
Yeah, I really hope so. I'm looking forward to this one, actually. Last time we played Hartlepool was 2004, I believe. I've never seen us play Hartlepool before. Selhurst Park was sold out 2 weeks ago for this. Hartlepool obviously be bringing a load of fans. I think it's something around 5,000. So, yeah, it should be a really good day, a really good atmosphere, and looking forward to hopefully getting along if my own injury allows. And yeah, I guess it's a chance for Eze to get more minutes for us. We'll maybe see some of our academy players on the bench too. But I also, you know, I hope we take it pretty seriously. Because as you say, Kev, it's been quite a while that Palace have had a cup run. Not really since that 2016 final, which I remember, which Pardew gif. Yeah, which I presume Joshy also remembers all too well. But yeah, I think it's a good chance for us. And you can, based on the team that Vieira played or started against Millwall in the last round, I think it's also a competition that he wants to go far in. So yeah, hoping we take it seriously. Hartlepool will obviously be there to try and cause an upset as well. But yeah, you know, win this and all of a sudden you're into the fifth round, not too far away from the kind of last eight, etc. So yeah, looking forward to a good day and hoping/expecting a win.
All right, and Josh, you're going to be hosting Middlesbrough, who I actually can pronounce, unlike apparently Hartlepool. My bad. What do you think we'll see in this one?
Yeah, I think, it's a home FA Cup tie against a team in Championship. You, as a Man United sort of fan, you expect us to come out and put in a performance that gets us the win, especially with the players that we've got and the break that we will have had by then. That being said, as I mentioned earlier, we're not playing that well. Teams do get at us, even at Old Trafford. You know, it's not a fortress by any stretch of the imagination. And Middlesbrough are in pretty good form. I think 8 wins out of their last 10. So it's 8 wins, a draw and a loss in the last 10 matches in all competitions. So doing all right, 6th in the Championship. So it's not like they're mugs. So I'm sure they fancy their chances given the way we're playing. So that could be a pretty good cup tie for the neutral or, you know, non-United fans to sort of maybe tune into and watch, because it's just one of those that, you know, you can just see Middlesbrough coming in doing something at Old Trafford. I hope not. But yeah, as you can tell, I'm not super confident with this team at the moment. So yeah, we'll see how it goes. Obviously, FA Cup, good opportunity for us, because we're not going to win the Champions League. We're not going to win the league. So it's the last opportunity rather than a good opportunity. So we really need to hopefully we do approach it with the right attitude, get that win and then move on into the next round.
Yeah, and I will say, I always think that fans are very foolish when they mock or cheer other big clubs being knocked out of the cup, because it is very much in Tottenham's interest for you to have a very deep cup run and have your attention split between the two. So here's to all the best in your cup exploits the remainder of the season.
Yeah, but this is the thing, right? If you as a Spurs fan want us to go further in and also in the Champions League and then maybe get knocked out in the semis or whatever, so that we take our eye off the league. But when we get knocked out, obviously you can laugh, because it's kind of like, well, you know, you're rubbish. So you sort of, both sides of it, you're kind of all right with both sides of it.
Oh, so I can't have a cake and eat it too moment. All right, quarterfinals, quarters or semis. we'll leave things there. If you guys would like to tell folks where they can find you or anything you're working on, now would be a good time.
Yeah, cheers, Kev. Cheers, Joshy. Always good to chat with you both. If anyone out there would like to read or listen to any more of my stuff, you can find me at sam_cop.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Always enjoy coming on the pod. You can find me on Twitter at docj_MUFC. And yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, I'm your host, Kevin DeVries. You can find me at Kevroff. You can find the show at EPL Roundtable on.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Twitter, and by searching EPL Roundtable on all of your podcast services. Massive thanks to these two for coming on during an air quotes international break. And folks at home, we hope you keep listening.